He's no nonsense. Speaks his mind. Says what you're thinking and other horrible cliches. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
Indy, Sirius XM 104.
Very excited to be joined by our next guest. He's pretty much the man when it comes time to talk about elections and election law and all things that impact elections. He's also a political scientist. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. In 2001 to 2010, he served as a founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal. And he's the author of The Voting Wars, From 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Really excited to talk to him about a couple of different issues, including campaign finance reform, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. At least that's how people are saying it. We'll see what the fine professor thinks. Richard Hasten is joining us. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So let's first start on what happened at the Supreme Court with the Voting Rights Act and Section 5. And remember, you have to talk to me like a small child, because this stuff is really confusing. But the Voting Rights Act was passed for a certain reason, and one part of it was struck down by the Supreme Court for, well, other reasons. What was it passed for, and what does this mean?
Well, back in 1965, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, and one part of the act required that states and some local jurisdictions with a history of discrimination in voting on the basis of race have to get permission from the federal government, either from the Department of Justice or from a court, before they make any changes to their voting rules. This is known as the preclearance requirement. When Congress enacted that part of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, it was only supposed to last for 5 years. It was extended for another 5 years, then for 7 years. In 1982, it was extended for 25 years. More states were added along the way. And in 2006, most recently, Congress extended it for yet another 25 years. And what the Supreme Court said in a case it decided last month called Shelby County versus Holder was that the formula that Congress used to decide which state should be covered was unconstitutional. What Congress did was they used the same list of states and the same data back from the 1960s. They didn't change the formula. And the Supreme Court said that there's a principle in the Constitution that all states have to be treated equally. This was news to many of us, because it seemed to be a new development here, this idea, and that this was impinging on state sovereignty, that Congress didn't have the power under the 14th and 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment, of course, gives Congress the power to pass laws to protect against discrimination and the right to vote. And the court said, this is unconstitutional, Congress. You can go back and you can rethink this formula, but for now there is no more preclearance, leaving states like Texas with its voter ID law to be able to implement them immediately, as opposed to having to go to court to get permission to do it by proving that the law would not make minority voters worse off.
One thing I think is certainly worth mentioning is when the Voting Rights Act was extended, the vote, at least in the Senate, was 98-0. I mean, Congress voted overwhelmingly to extend this. I mean, 98-0. We don't ever see that, I don't think, ever. And yet the Supreme Court basically reversed a congressional vote. Right? Am I missing anything there?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. First, it did pass by 98-0, but Justice Scalia, during argument, said anything that passes 98-0 is something we should be skeptical about. It's kind of an ironic statement for him to make, because his confirmation vote was 98-0.
Is that so?
A point he may have forgotten.
I had no idea. I never heard that. That's interesting. Go ahead.
In fact, beneath the surface of the 98-0 vote was a growing view on the Republican side that this part of the Voting Rights Act was unconstitutional. And in fact, although all of the Republican senators voted for renewal of the Voting Rights Act, they issued a report, a committee report, where they suggested the act was unconstitutional. And we just heard from Karl Rove soon after the Supreme Court's decision this time around that President Bush, when he signed the Voting Rights Act, suspected that part of it was unconstitutional, even though he didn't mention a word of that. His ceremony signing the act was just a big celebration of this achievement. But beneath the surface, there was this concern that it was unconstitutional. And in fact, since 2006, you've seen more and more Republicans saying that. Rick Perry, when he was a presidential candidate, talked about the federal government going to war with South Carolina and Texas, which is kind of incendiary language coming from a former Confederate area. But suggesting that this was, in fact, a federal overreach. And the conservative justices on the Supreme Court agreed in a 5-4 decision. And so now it's back in Congress, and this time around, you hear many members of Congress, Republicans, saying, we don't need to fix the Voting Rights Act. What the remaining parts of the Voting Rights Act are enough. We don't need anything else.
Well, what protections were stripped, and what is the news as a result almost immediately? I know there's a lot of states have moved to change certain laws. So what protections have been stripped, and what laws have immediately certain states made an effort to change because of the new allowance, the new freedom they have?
Right. So, it's still so new. So some of these lawsuits that are going on, everyone's trying to sort out what's going on. But it looks like Texas is going to be able to implement its voter ID law, which is among one of the toughest in the country. No student ID is allowed to vote, but a concealed weapons permit is fine as your ID to vote. Texas also engaged in a redistricting that was not approved. That went to court, and the a court in Washington, D.C. said that at least in one instance, the state of Texas was engaged in intentional racial discrimination in how it drew its lines for its legislative districts. So all of those suits should end up the portion under the preclearance provision should end up going away. There will be other lawsuits to try to stop Texas's redistricting and its ID laws under other provisions of the Voting Rights Act, under the Constitution. The standard is different. The burden of proof is different. It's just much harder. One of the things Section 5 did is it put the burden on these covered jurisdictions to prove their changes wouldn't make minority voters worse off, and that's the protection that's gone. And so you see in North Carolina, which had a number of its counties covered under Section 5, that the Republican legislature is moving now to pass a new, very strict, like Texas's, voter ID law. And if that passes, it could go into effect immediately unless some plaintiffs come in and try to get use some other provision of the Voting Rights Act or something else to try and block it. There'll be no approval process. There'll be no checking to see
if
minority voters are worse off.
If you had to describe voter ID laws in general, in a word, what word would you choose?
Unnecessary. And I think there's a lot of exaggeration on both sides in the voter ID debate. But I think a key point is that the main thing that voter ID laws prevent is impersonation voter fraud. I go to the polls, I say I'm Pete Dominick, and I vote in your name. It's just not something that happens very often.
Oh, it happens all the time that people want to be me.
Well,
but not vote as me, yeah.
Great website. They want to be you, but they don't want to vote for you because that's a felony, and it's really hard to swing an election. There's a great website called News 21. It's a journalist... a journalism school set up a database of all of the election prosecutions in the entire country since 2000. And you can look and you can see hundreds of cases of absentee ballot fraud, something that the voter ID laws don't do anything to prevent. Many prosecutions for election officials committing fraud. Only 10 prosecutions, and we think they led to maybe 7 convictions in the whole country since 2000 for impersonation fraud, and never any kind of scheme that was actually going to.
That's really, I mean, those statistics are pretty convincing. But the other thing that I've heard that convinces me, Professor, we're talking to Rick Hasen, who's really the expert on election law, is it's one thing to just say there's a handful of fraud, but no, there's never been an example where any kind of fraudulent voting changed the outcome of an election. I don't want to say never, but certainly not in a long time where any kind of hijinks like that, fraudulent voting, has changed the outcome of election. Am I right?
We've had elections tainted by fraud.
Sure.
Not by the kind of fraud that a voter ID law prevents. So in Miami, back in 1997, a judge changed the results of the mayor's race because there was so much absentee ballot fraud. There is some fraud in elections, but it almost always involves absentee ballots because then you can verify how someone voted outside the presence of the polling place. Or it happens with election officials committing fraud. It just doesn't happen on this scale with this kind of impersonation fraud. Never seen a case. I looked since 1980 to try and find a case. Couldn't find a single one where you could even suspect that an election was tainted by that kind of fraud that a voter ID law would prevent. Although I'd say on the other side that I think there's a lot of exaggeration as to the number of people who are disenfranchised by these laws. It turns out in most cases, most people who want to get ID and want to vote are able to do so. Yes, it's an additional burden, but they're able to do so. An interesting case is Pennsylvania. They're in trial right now over its voter ID law that was put on hold by the courts there, the state courts. The question is whether the State Department of Transportation can get its act together and actually get the IDs into the hands of the few hundred thousand people who don't have them and want them. And there's a real question about institutional competence there, whether they can actually get their program together in time for the next election.
There's so much more to talk about with that issue, but I want to get to the recent piece that you wrote about campaign finance reform. It's titled Three Wrong Progressive Approaches and One Right One to Campaign Finance Reform. Professor Richard Hasen joining us right now of UC Irvine, and he is really one of the foremost, strongest, smartest voices on election and campaign laws. And I've said a lot of times that every issue that we talk about on this show really can be watered down a lot to money in campaigns and campaign finance issues. It's not quite that simple. But nonetheless, many people argue that we need to change the way that we finance campaigns, the way politicians get elected and the kind of money that they need. You've written and talked a lot about campaign Citizens United and what that changed. But I really want for you to be able to put as much as you can in a box these approaches and this paper. I know we don't have much time left, but I want to give you as much time as you can to explain the points you're trying to make in this piece.
Well, you know, the question I'm addressing in this piece is what should people who support campaign finance reform do these days? Because the Supreme Court and Citizens United and other cases has made it very hard to limit the amount of money in politics. And the Federal Election Commission has essentially been stymied by the actions of the Republican commissioners who are opposed to regulation. So it's not doing much.
Yeah, how many commissioners are there and how many are Republican and how many are Democrat?
There's supposed to be six commissioners. Right now there are five. All of them are holdovers because Congress hasn't approved any new ones, although now we may get two new ones approved. But generally four votes to do anything. And they've been dividing. It's not that they're dividing on party lines where the Republicans are always voting to support Republicans and Democrats to support Democrats, but on ideological lines. The Republicans almost always vote against regulation and against putting reasonable limits and rules in place, rules on coordination and on other kinds of issues. So the question is, what can you do in this environment? And I take on three solutions that other progressives have put forward and argue that they're bad ideas. One is a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. And what I try and show is that either the amendment would be very weak and easy to get around, in which case it would be useless, or more likely, and if you look at, for example, the amendment that has been proposed by Senator Tester of Montana, it would really squelch a lot of free speech that progressives should not want to squelch. That is, we're all in favor of getting money out of politics to prevent corruption and maybe to promote a kind of level playing field, but you don't want to stop robust political debate. And some of these measures are written so broadly that they actually would make it very hard for people to engage in politics. And one of the measures would require every local and state government to regulate campaign finance, and that would be in the Constitution, require it. And that seems like it goes too far. So that's one approach. Second approach is the approach of lip service, where, and I think President Obama has been guilty of this, as many Democrats have, you talk against Citizens United, but you don't really do anything. So you look at President Obama, he was the first general election candidate to not take presidential public financing. He set up this Organizing for America, the successor to his campaign organization, which is pushing the envelope on what campaign finance groups can do under the tax code and the elections code. So that, I think, is progressive should not be taken in by the lip service.
And then, because they say, because the president and others will say, we need to change this. In the meantime, they're taking advantage of the rules and benefiting from them with their own 501c3s or whatever nonprofits, right?
Sure. So, right. So they say, well, you know, we don't believe in unilateral disarmament. I understand that. But the president has not led on this. He has not recess-appointed federal election commissioners, which he could have done. He promised to come up with a system to fix, a proposal to fix the public financing system. He hasn't done that. So I think there's a lot more he could have done to lead, but he hasn't done. This has not been a priority for his administration.
Right.
Other than, you know, yelling at the Supreme Court justices during the State of the Union, he's not really been a leader on this issue.
Right.
And then the last thing is just throw in the towel. And I look at Ezra Klein and Jonathan Bernstein, both of them very smart, progressive people writing. Klein showing some skepticism of the existing laws and, you know, even what we have left. And Bernstein saying we should get rid of contribution limits, which is an argument that the right usually makes. And I argue, no, what we need to do is, in fact, try to preserve what's left in the meantime, try to promote innovative public financing schemes like those that might use vouchers, to give voters vouchers to be able to give to political parties and to candidates, and see if that will empower people to become more involved in politics. They'll have money to use for political purposes. And also to build the kind of thought and architecture so that when the Supreme Court changes, and I think it will be changing in the next decade or so to be a more liberal Supreme Court as Kennedy and Scalia retire, if there is a Democratic president, it's likely that the court moves to the left, to create the right environment so that the courts can overturn Citizens United and allow Congress to restore reasonable campaign finance rules.
So in a way, you're pointing to waiting, the idea that there could be, you know, waiting, I don't want to say waiting it out, but the fact that once you have a different makeup in the Supreme Court, which of course, folks, if you're undecided on who to vote for president, the next president for sure is going to probably make some appointments. This president has about 1,200 more days, so you never know what could happen. But are you saying wait it out for the Supreme Court makeup to change so that laws can be changed?
Well, I would say wait it out compared to changing the Constitution, which has been
right.
But I would also say there's still some room to do innovative things like with public financing, and there's still a lot of law that needs to be defended. The Supreme Court is going to hear yet another campaign finance case this fall where they might start taking on the rules on campaign contributions, which so far the court has not done. And so there is this concern that, you know, we have to play defense now and plan for offense in the future. And that I think, is the way to move forward, to preserve what you've got, to try and come up with what innovative things you can within the realm of what the Supreme Court says you can do right now, and then look forward to the future.
You're the best. I appreciate you joining us and teaching us, and it's great to be part of your classroom. Professor Richard Hasen, and you can follow him on Twitter, at Rick Hasen. Everybody should be following Rick on Twitter, Hasen. He's a must-follow on Twitter, and hopefully we'll get a lot of new followers from this interview. Professor, thanks so much for joining us today. Really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
America's Next Top Model. Stand up with Pete Dominic.